Mr. Ragland, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Thomas Ragland, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Temitope Akinsadi, in this case. Your Honors, it is undisputed that Mr. Akinsadi and his criminal proceedings in the year 2000 suffered constitutionally deficient assistance of counsel. The district court judge found, and the government has not contested, that he met one of the Strickland tests for ineffective assistance. The issue before the court, Your Honors, is whether at prong two of Strickland he showed prejudice. The district court found that the Rule 11 plea colloquy proceedings, which included a general admonishment, if you are not a citizen, you may be deported, was sufficient to cure any prejudice that may have occurred as a result of his attorney's misadvice.
How did those pages get omitted from the joint appendix?
Your Honor, my understanding is that Mr. Akinsadi's previous counsel, Mr. Basil, prepared the joint appendix and they were omitted. The government cured that omission either before or I believe before I came into the case, or certainly those pages appear now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the government advocates a general rule, a blanket rule, that where the court during the Rule 11 proceedings has advised a defendant that immigration consequences may result from accepting a plea, that cures whatever prejudice may have occurred as a result of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the government cited a number of cases that talk about a warning curing that. However, none of those cases are on point for this specific case, and none of them relate to the factors that other courts have found in which the warning does not cure the misadvice. Your Honor, if I may, the issue here and why this case is extraordinary and why it's also quite rare and is not likely to open any floodgates of post-conviction relief litigation is because Mr. Akinsadi was subject to what might be characterized as a perfect storm of prejudice. Number one, it's clear from the record that immigration consequences were a central concern of Mr. Akinsadi. The record reflects that on at least two occasions he inquired of his criminal counsel, will this have an effect on my immigration status? He'd been in the country since he was 7 years old. His mother was a U.S. citizen. His other relatives were lawful residents. He had an application pending for lawful residence based on a petition filed by his U.S. citizen mother. He was 19 years old. His central focus, according to the record, was how would this affect his immigration status?
What we have here is, as you point out, the prong one, and probably the government will agree that it was ineffective as a counsel in his affidavit. It said, I specifically told this individual that it was not a deportable offense. Typically, if the counsel has simply omitted giving advice, or there is no indication that the defendant has been advised, so forth, and then the court comes and tells you something different, in most instances, you would think that the advice of the court would trump any advice that a defendant would have heard from his counsel. And here the court said specifically that you realize if you're an immigrant, then there are consequences that can flow from this. And I take it your position is that a defendant in that position cannot rely on the court's advice, but instead should be held to have accepted the advice of his counsel, which was not only just he didn't advise him, and I think in the Padilla case, was it that he just didn't advise him, or did he advise him wrongly, as was done here?
In the Padilla case, he advised him wrongly. There was affirmative misadvice, as there was in this case.
So there is affirmative misadvice here. And well, and I guess that's the issue we've got to make. Try to get to what is the judicial choice here. We've got to make a decision, don't you think,
yeah,
as to what is the import of that court's advice during the proceeding? You sort of characterize it sort of like when you're doing a loan closing and you got all these warnings within it, and who reads it or who understands it? You rely upon what's being said to you. And this has been said specifically to him. And the trial, the district court felt differently, that in fact that was sufficient to give him that kind of basis. So isn't that the, where we are? I mean, we can go with all the other facts. We can talk about how old he was. And it's a sad situation. I mean, when you think about it in terms of all he's done, and but this is not a case of equity from that perspective. We are dealing specifically with this case. So isn't that the decision we got to make? And maybe that's what makes it unusual, is maybe a court wouldn't have made those affirmative statements in there.
It is, Judge Wynn, and that's precisely, you anticipated precisely my point, and when I was speaking of the four factors that make this case unique. Number two is that in this case, it wasn't that his counsel failed to advise him that he could be deportable or that he would be deportable. At least two occasions, his counsel specifically misadvised him that if you plead to this, you will not be deported. In fact, you'll become a citizen.
I interrupt you, but I think what Judge Wynn's saying is let's assume performance was deficient.
Okay.
Now let's look at prejudice. Mm-hmm. Now, to determine prejudice, we got to look at what the judge told him.
That's right.
So if you would go, I hate to cut you off, you don't have to.
Okay.
That's what I think, I know I'm interested in how you would suggest we handle the misadvice from the attorney, but the warning given by the trial judge.
Yes, thank you, Chief Troxler. The issue here is that the misadvice and the general warning, it's two different issues. The Rule 11 plea colloquy is designed to ensure due process protections for a defendant, that he understand the consequences of giving up certain constitutional protections and accepting a plea as opposed to going to trial. The purpose of the court's warnings are to put a defendant on notice that there are these civil ramifications, potential deportability, loss of voting rights, can't own a firearm, etc. And so the purpose of the colloquy is to put a defendant on notice. And if Mr. Al-Khansadi had never had any advice, had never had any misadvice, then I would submit that the court saying, if you're not a citizen, you may be deported, would ring alarm bells in his head and say, well, I need to talk to my attorney about that. But that's not what happened here. What happened here was, under the Sixth Amendment protection to effective assistance of counsel, he had already specifically inquired of his attorney, will this make me deportable? I don't want to plead to this if it's going to make me deportable, and had twice been reassured by his attorney that you can plead to this, it will not make you deportable. You're not deportable unless you have two felony convictions, so you're safe in pleading to this. So the purpose of the Rule 11 warnings in this case were trumped by the reason affirmative misadvice matters. No advice wouldn't overcome it, but the affirmative misadvice overcomes it.
You can't have a rule that information given to the defendant outside of court that contradicts what the judge tells him will trump the judge's question and answer that's given. Just can't be that way.
Well, Your Honor, the courts that have looked at this have drawn a distinction between the cases where the court has made a specific warning. You will be deported. You are likely to be deported. Do you understand that you're almost certainly going to be deported? Versus a general warning in the plea colloquy, such as a general warning in this case, that there may be immigration consequences.
That may be a stronger point, that the warning that was given here was not sufficient.
And that goes into my
contention
that there are factors that bring this case into to be a fairly unique circumstance. The affirmative misadvice and the discussion in the Padilla case regarding the impact of defective counsel and affirmative misadvice, and specifically Justice Alito's concurrence, where he states that suggests that affirmative misadvice, as opposed to insufficient advice, undermines the very nature of the proceedings, that it would cause us to question the very fundamental fairness, undermines the reliability of the defendant's ability to plead, and that the plea be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. So the reason affirmative misadvice matters so much is that I'm not suggesting that in every case where you meet prong one and the court's warning is general, that doesn't cure it. It can. What I'm suggesting is that where there is specific affirmative misadvice about the deportation consequences and the court's warning is not specific and there's no searching inquiry, but it's just a general admonishment, that that doesn't automatically cure. And the cases that support that.
When the law, defense lawyer and defendant come in for the Rule 11 hearing, the trial judge doesn't know what has been told.
That's right.
So what he's trying to do is verify for himself this person understands the consequences of his actions. So, you know, anything, I'm trying to look at it from the trial judge's perspective mm-hmm. to make sure that when they question, their questions are full and comprehensive and that they get a response that indicates whether or not the defendant truly understands what's going on. But you're wanting, it seems to me you're wanting to make a big factor in all of this evaluation, what's going on beforehand, which is something the trial judge just doesn't know about.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. The trial judge did nothing wrong here. He did precisely what he was required to do, and his colloquy was perfectly adequate. The issue is not that the trial judge should have done something differently, should have engaged in a more probing inquiry. The issue is that where these factors come into play, concern about central concern of immigration consequences, affirmative misadvice by counsel, a general warning by the court, that these factors create a circumstance where it is a case where post-conviction relief in the form of quorum nobis, which requires an extraordinary level, is an extraordinary remedy, requires extraordinary facts.
But
that rises
true,
to...
If that's, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if that's true, what can a trial judge doing a Rule 11 colloquy do to ensure that this plea is attack-proof, so to speak, that he's gotten, mm-hmm. made the right information and gotten a truthful answer, and the defendant understands what the rules are going to be?
Well, I would submit
what
that
the consequences
that,
could be.
I would submit that it's not on the trial judge to make those assurances. It's on the attorney. It's the attorney's obligation to provide effective assistance, not the court's. Now, if what could the court do? In the courts have found, the cases have found that where the court did go further and specifically inquire or did say, you will be deported, do you understand that you are almost certain to be deported, that was sufficient to cure the misadvice. But I wouldn't suggest that the trial judge is under any obligation to find out. That's the attorney's requirement. And the attorney's requirement.
You're on the first prong, we're dealing with prejudice, but I will ask you this question. Mm-hmm. The focus seems to be that the nature of the ineffective assistance focused on his initial advice. Is there any further allegation that was ineffective of the counsel once the judge advised him in this matter, which was contrary to his advice, to then provide assistance to his client? It says, the judge has stated this. Mm-hmm. I told you this. Let me explain why this is there. And that did not occur.
That did not occur, Your Honor.
But I'm not sure I gather from your brief that you have contended that was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, Your Honor, the defense counsel's assistance was ineffective. I would submit that the judge's warning didn't specifically contradict what the lawyer had said. The judge said, if you're not a citizen, you may be deported if you're convicted of a felony. That's accurate. What the defense counsel said was, that may be the case, you're pleading guilty only to theft, and you're not deportable unless you have two convictions. And so a single conviction for theft is not going to make you deportable.
I'm failing to see how that doesn't contradict it. If he says, I advise the defendant that a guilty plea in this matter will be a single guilty plea to theft, and such a conviction would not constitute a deportable offense. The judge advised, if you're not a citizen, you could be deported. Sounds like it contradicts to me.
Well, I think that it would raise the, as I said at the outset, it would certainly put the defendant on notice that
has to do with the ineffective assistance of counsel. And maybe you're not feeling me in terms of that I'm trying to push you to get me to understand mm-hmm. that. Why is that not in assistance of counsel? Once a judge says that in face of what he said is that's contradictory, why would it not be in assistance of counsel also to not at that point correct what you've done affirmatively wrong, you know, to get this guy to come in and plead?
I wouldn't deny that it is, Your Honor. I think that the counsel
was as much as saying, "Come in." There's no way in the world you would go to jail. And he says, "Okay, I'll take the plea." Mm-hmm. He goes in. The judge says, "You may go to jail." At some point, somebody ought to say something, and he's got a counsel who's represented him. And my question is that the nature of ineffective assistance of counsel that would satisfy, in and of itself, would satisfy Strickland on the first prong?
That is the nature of ineffective assistance, and as this court said in United States versus Smith, the requirement of the Sixth Amendment is not that you have counsel, not that your counsel be present, but that effective counsel be present. And the amendment itself says you're entitled to effective assistance of counsel, not that you're entitled to have a counsel. And so if the counsel is not performing his duty, and specifically where the counsel goes so far as to ensure the defendant of the opposite of what is true, that misadvice rises to the level. And the court.
One last question, yes, on this, which is procedural. Maybe I'm just thinking too quickly on it. When one, when it has been determined, even I guess in a post-trial proceeding of ineffective assistance of counsel, the cure for ineffective assistance of counsel is to go back and to set aside the earlier conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because of the delay and how long this has been gone, and appeals have all gone from this.
That's right.
You can't do that. You can't go back and set aside that initial conviction. But if the Supreme Court or the court says, as a matter of law, it was ineffective, it seems almost, seems like something's not right. He's gotten a conviction on his record for clearly it was ineffective assistance of counsel. Of course, here he's interested in deportation, but, you know, he's got this conviction that's clearly just ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, I think that's precisely right, Your Honor, and it's why quorum nobis exists. And one of the factors is there's no other available remedy. He couldn't have directly appealed. His habeas period was over, and the judge found below he provided valid and sound reasons for not bringing an appeal or not bringing post-conviction relief earlier.
Ask one last thing when you come back, because
yes.
I know the chief is getting ready to point out your time is out. I don't think this circuit has articulated a standard of review that the that we apply for the district court denial of a writ of quorum nobis. And if you can talk just a moment on that, because I...
Now, or would you like me to sit down first?
When you come back.
I certainly will, Your
Honor. The chief is going to send you out, so I'm anticipating that.
Thank you.
Ms. Brewer.
May it please the court, my name is Kristen Sproul and I represent the United States. There are some threshold issues that the court stressed before we reach the Rule 11 colloquy. The first is whether Padilla v. Kentucky should be applied to the defendant's claim, because Padilla sets out a new rule of criminal procedure pursuant to Teague v. Lane that cannot be applied to a collateral claim. Second, in dealing with the Strickland issue,
So we've got circuits going one way, circuits going the other way, and we just got to make a decision. It's pretty much already been argued. We've got to pick one of them, right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, yes. And the government would argue that there are several reasons that that Padilla is a new rule and cannot be applied to cases on collateral review.
But it's going on an old constitution. It's a rule that arises from an old constitution. So what? If I was leaning, I'd probably lean and say, you know, nothing new about this. The nature of the ineffective assistance is the same as it was before then, and even though it was articulated that you ought to do it. I mean, it's been fairly understood that you ought not advise your client ineffectively. And what arises from it in light of Padilla is kind of an articulation of what has been there, right?
Your Honor, what is new about Padilla is not what it applies, and Your Honor is correct that is the Constitution. It's where it applies, and that is the immigration consequences of a plea agreement. That is a new rule, and in fact directly contradicts existing Fourth Circuit law, specifically United States v. Yearwood, which specifically...
Is that what Justice Alito said in his opinion, that it was new stuff and it wasn't something that already existed?
Yes, Your Honor. Padilla did not address retroactivity, and that's because it arose from a state court, and Teague does not necessarily apply to the states pursuant to Danforth v. Minnesota. Though retroactivity was not addressed, Justice Alito was very clear that this is a new rule that is directly contradicted by existing precedent at the time, including 11 circuit courts, countless district courts, and state courts.
To follow up on the point Judge Wynn made, despite that, we have precedent in this court that while an attorney does not have a responsibility to advise a criminal defendant of collateral consequences, if the defendant asks and the defendant and the lawyer advises him, there's a responsibility on the lawyer to not grossly misadvise the client. And if he does so, then there's been deficient performance. So regardless of this retroactivity issue, I'm telling you there's precedent in this circuit that if a lawyer grossly misadvises a client about a collateral consequence that the client inquires about, there's deficient performance. So we may be arguing over something that may not be an issue in this case.
I would add, Your Honor, that in United States v. Yearwood, which was a precedent that had been regularly cited by district courts, in that case, it was a misrepresentation by counsel about the immigration consequences of a plea. And it was in that case that this court held that immigration, a collateral consequence of a plea, even if there was misinformation, that that was not an effective assistance of counsel. In addition, Your Honor, Padilla rests on a novel analysis of the status of deportation as a consequence of conviction. It specifically noted that withdrew immigration from the direct versus collateral consequences of a plea and stated that immigration was unique and it was like criminal, but it was different. And this was a very novel analysis of the direct versus collateral consequence, which shows that this, and in fact, it's somewhat...
Oh, still on the retroactivity?
Yes, Your Honor. Would you like me to move on to the prejudice?
Oh, I think you can use your time however you like. I thought Chief had sort of addressed that for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's right. We're not cutting y'all.
No?
All right. I appreciate that. I will be brief on retroactivity because, Your Honor, I do believe that Yearwood was the prevailing precedent at the time of the defendant's plea, and it was very specific that misrepresentation of immigration consequences of a plea is not an effective assistance of counsel. And that is something that was changed by the Padilla opinion, and therefore it is a new rule that should not be applied to this case on collateral review. And in fact, it will open the floodgates to such claims. And that is because this is not a unique case like the defense counsel argued. This is a case that is popping up very similar facts all around the country. And there are lower court decisions that are all over the map.
It assumes that prong one has been satisfied on Strickland. And I take it if it is retroactive, you would agree that prong one would have been satisfied under Strickland?
Pursuant to Padilla, yes, Your Honor.
And so now we're dealing with the question of prejudice. How do you respond to the comments made by your colleague on the other side?
First, Your Honor, before we even reach the Rule 11 colloquy, the issue under Hill is whether there is a reasonable probability that the defendant would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. And this is dependent on the likely outcome of a trial had the defendant not pled guilty. The evidence here, Your Honors, was formidable. It was very, very strong. The defendant was a teller at Chevy Chase Bank. He took three checks, fraudulent checks, from accomplices. He fraudulently cashed those checks, deposited those checks, and put some of that money directly into his own account. If he had gone to trial, given the weight of this evidence, it is exceedingly likely, if not inevitable, that the defendant would have been convicted.
You know, things were different back in 2000 than 2009. You know, when someone would plead to this kind of thing, being deported, I think it was pretty common. I'm not sure they were done as quickly as they're done now. And so, you know, to say that he would not have pled or he would have pled if he knew that he would be deported under the circumstances now, because deportation was pretty serious to him in 2000, I'm not sure I'm following that. I mean, should we look at the way things were done at different times to put it in the context of whether it was reasonable for a defendant to plead? If the practice, for the most part, because he waited all these years. I mean, and then finally we know that the laws and the manners in which things have been enforced have changed over the years. So it's a whole different focus now. You walk in now, no counsel would advise anybody that you wouldn't be deported now. But in 2000, this was, maybe they were kind of lax about it or whatever. But, and I guess I'm not following, at least if I'm looking temporally, 2000 as opposed to 09.
Your Honor, I can't speak to deportation proceedings in the year 2000. That's outside my experience. But I will note that in this particular case, it is in the record that between the time of the plea hearing and the sentencing, the defendant went to his interview with immigration authorities. And it's in the immigration record in the whereas deportation is pending in the Second Circuit that an immigration officer there stated, looked at the interview record of the defendant and noted that he did not apply affirmatively that he had any arrests or convictions.
The practice, I mean, state of Virginia, you travel over 15 miles an hour, I think I'm right on this, you can go to jail for a year. But I think for the most part, nobody really goes to jail for a year if you're traveling 15 miles an hour, unless there's something else there. If all of a sudden the law was changed, or at least the practice was changed, in which you absolutely go to jail, and if a lawyer goes and says, well, you're not going jail, you're going to be all right, that would be ineffective if the practice changed. And so that's what I'm asking is, if the practice has changed so that in 2000, to advise a person in this manner, basically you would, the practice is you're not going to be deported. But in fact, it becomes mandatory in time. Doesn't that sort of change, I mean, the analysis? Don't we have to consider the temporalness when we're looking at in terms of whether, you know, the prejudice is here? When he chooses to plea or not to plea?
Your Honor, that is one analysis that's considered within retroactivity, which is whether this is a new rule. And yes, Your Honor, whether the court should consider the standard at the time as to whether or not an attorney was deficient in his advice. And in this case, the defendant himself was going through immigration proceedings during the time of this case, and therefore he was very well aware of the deportation proceedings, of immigration issues and law.
That doesn't help your case. That makes the case strong on the other side. It was a big concern for him, and it was very important for him to get sound advice from his counsel. As I understood your argument, what you were arguing was that it wouldn't make any difference because if he had gone to trial, the evidence was so overwhelming, the result would have been different. But I'd like you to address this. I think the question here is, would he have been able to attempt to fashion a better plea agreement? Because he cooperated, remember, he self-reported, he turned himself in, he made restitution, he cooperated. If everybody knew that deportation was in the offing here, then counsel perhaps would have at least had the opportunity to say, wait a minute, my client can't get deported. Can we make this thing a misdemeanor and give him 12 months in jail? That's the question. That's the potential prejudice. Is the what you like? I always say that I practice law. That the key to practicing law is managing clients' expectations. Some clients tell you, "Listen, I just can't go to jail." Others tell you, "Look, I can't lose my job." The ones that can't lose the job, they get work release and go to jail over on weekends. The ones that can't go to jail, they say, "Look, I'll take the felony and I'll go home." That's important for counsel to give sound advice. And when you say, no, you are not going to be deported, he says, well, fine. I'll plead to it because I'm not going to be deported. So when you address that, you're addressing the outcome of going to trial. What about the opportunity to fashion, as all lawyers do all the time, plea agreements?
Your Honor, as an officer of the court, as an assistant United States attorney, I'm obligated to present the facts to the court. Here, the facts are that the defendant embezzled over $16,000. In a plea agreement, sometimes a defendant is permitted to plead guilty to one charge or another charge, but we are not permitted by Department of Justice policy to misconstrue the facts. And that's what would have been necessary here for the defendant to plead to a non-aggravated felony. There were three checks. The defendant took a benefit of those checks.
Misconstrue the facts.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You said misconstrue the facts.
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand, Your Honor, to fashion a plea agreement for something that is not an aggravated felony would require a loss amount of less than $10,000.
You mean like those people who testify against people who committed all kinds of crimes, never get indicted in the system, those kind of things? You have a problem doing what? Somebody pleading to something lesser?
Your Honor, in terms of the facts, they don't change. And the defendant here doesn't claim that he stole less than $16,000. He pled guilty to that. He admitted that that is true. So there really is no...
So you're saying that under these facts, there was no opportunity to make a plea agreement for less than a fellow aggravated felony?
Your Honor, it would be a... potentially there is some other charge he could have pled to. If he was pleading to bank fraud as he did here, the loss amount is what the loss amount is.
Let me ask you this. I don't understand in your analysis where the judge's advice fits into the analysis of the prejudice. So could you tell me
Yes, Your Honor. How
you propose that be handled?
Yes, Your Honor. The first step is whether there would be a difference in the outcome of the proceeding, which I have argued. And the second step is whether the prejudice had been cured by the judge's colloquy. And even the district court in this case noted that it is a dangerous precedent to find that a defendant's words at a plea hearing do not mean what they say. This would open the door to innumerable variations of challenges to guilty pleas. It is important to the stability of the criminal justice system that plea agreements and plea hearings are final and that they are certain. And a mere allegation of misadvice from a defense attorney should not be sufficient to force the courts to revisit a conviction from a decade ago. And in this case, the defendant went to a plea hearing. He was placed under oath. He was told that he could ask his counsel anything at any time. And the district court went through certain requirements, certain notifications as required by Rule 11. And he also added that this offense of embezzlement is a felony. And if you are found guilty of felony, there are certain civil ramifications that flow from this. If you are not a citizen, you could be deported. He then asked, "Do you understand that?" And the defendant replied, "Yes, Your Honor." And the court asked, "Knowing that, you still wish to plead guilty?" "Yes, Your Honor." Your Honor, the court here, the district court here, is an Article III court, of course. It is not an immigration court, and it is the executive who has the power to deport a non-citizen. The district court could not be more certain than saying you could be deported, because it's certainly not a certainty. He didn't have the power to order that deportation. This is a warning to the defendant. He had the opportunity to speak to his...
Was it years later that the deportation proceeded? Why didn't it just happen right then?
Your Honor, my understanding from the immigration court record is that the defendant was rearrested.
But he wasn't deported.
His deportation proceedings are pending. They are now in the Second Circuit.
I'm talking about in the year 2000 when the initial charge. Why was he not deported then?
Your Honor, my understanding is that he was not deported because he went to he received his green card between the plea agreement and the sentencing when the conviction became final, it was that confusion is my understanding is why he was not immediately deported.
9 years of it. Was it 9 years?
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
I mean, is that the way it's done now?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't have...
Hasn't there been a change in the policy and the way this is done? Isn't that what really has happened here?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. I do apologize.
And this is where I go with it. I'm trying to make it make sense, because when you see two things happen, you see a counsel... I'm assuming this counsel was competent. He knew what he was doing. And you see the court advise something different. You try to make sense out of it. And so you say, well, the court says you could be deported if you're not a citizen as a matter of law. Counsel advises him, as a matter of fact, you won't be deported because that's the practice, much like the example I gave with the speeding. I mean, you could well see a judge advises the defendant, you could go to jail for 1 year just for speeding 16 miles over the speedy limit in the state, because that's reckless driving, that's 1 year. Counsel says, as a matter of fact, you won't go to jail. And he's basing that on because nobody goes to jail for that. But if the law changes or the policy changes, it's clearly ineffective. And it may be even ineffective for him to say it, you know, before, but it's clearly ineffective if the policy changes on it. And I'm wondering, do we take that in consideration here in trying to make sense out of it? Because I don't like to think that the court is telling something totally different than the counsel, and the counsel is just purely incompetent for doing so. And he even testified to this here. So there's a reason he comes forth and just testified that he just didn't give the right advice. And does that make a difference?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that hypothetical is the case here. The attorney's affidavit says that he told him as a matter of law you would not be deported. And the law has not changed between the year 2000 and the present as to what an aggravated felony is. But to answer your question, Your Honor, yes, we should consider whether a counsel's assistance was effective at the time. That is what Strickland requires. And
well, the attorney said that you could not be deported because you did not have two felony convictions. And I know it doesn't seem like it's important to anybody on the state, but it seems important to me that if the practice then was that you couldn't be, that they weren't deporting anybody unless you had two convictions. If you had one, you got deported. You didn't get deported. But if you had two, you did. I mean, do you have any notion as to whether what he was saying was in fact the practice at the time?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I just can't speak to deportation proceedings in the year 2000. I'm just not familiar with how INS...
It seems fair. It seems that, like, I'm just trying to think about it in terms of fairness. If you got a law and you're really not enforcing it, you're not doing it, and then all of a sudden, 9 years later, you change the rules. Everybody, one single offense, is going to be deported. I don't care if it happened 9 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Boom, you're gone. And here people went in pleading under a system where, you know, they never in their mind thought they were going to be deported because nobody was being deported. And you changed the rule, so to speak. And that's the part that's sort of missing for me here. But we know that's what happened. I mean, we understand how immigration, and I'm not getting into that, but I'm trying to deal with it and trying to establish this, your argument of prejudice by the district court in saying it. Because if he says it and nobody pays any attention because it's just not done, it's one thing. You know, did you just say it's the hard law? Yeah, he clearly said it was the hard law, but it's not as a fact.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. Would you like me to respond?
Please.
Your Honor, yes, we should consider the facts at the time. However, 2000 was not that long ago. The law has not changed. An aggravated felony did make somebody deportable.
That much we agree. I only question whether the practice has changed or whether the enforcement in terms of the immigration authorities has changed.
And unfortunately, Your Honor,
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Raglin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, I'll work backwards. I'll get to the standard for quorum nobis. Just to address Judge Wynn's questions briefly, I've been practicing. I'm older than my co-counsel. I was at the Department of Justice. I was in the Department of Justice at the time on the other side in the year 2000. What happened here was an aberration. The law has not changed and the practice has not changed. What happened was immigration dropped the ball. He was clearly deportable, mandatorily deportable, automatically deportable for an aggravated felony. The advice he received was absolutely contrary to what was true. And yet, immigration then gave him his green card. He traveled in and out of the country for years. He never had any contact with immigration until 9 years later. And that's when he was arrested and put into deportation proceedings and detained, et cetera. So that goes to the question of whether quorum nobis is an appropriate vehicle here, because that is the reason he had valid and sound reasons not to bring in a direct appeal, not to bring a 2255 action. He had no reason to know that he was deportable until he was arrested. Now, to address the question about the standard of review for quorum nobis, I didn't find any Fourth Circuits that specifically address this, Fourth Circuit cases, but the Fourth Circuit cases, Foster, United States versus Smith, say that legal conclusions of a district court are reviewed de novo, factual determinations are reviewed for clear error. I was able to find, I think the clearest explanation of the standard was in Santos Sanchez, which is a Fifth Circuit decision. And I'll read from it. On appeal from a district court's denial of a petition for writ of quorum nobis, we review factual findings for clear error, questions of law de novo, and the district court's ultimate decision to deny the writ for abuse of discretion. And that Orosio, in the Third Circuit, a very recent decision that addressed retroactivity, also collected cases from the Sixth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and essentially said the same thing. Legal issues are de novo, and so I would propose that this is a legal question. It's a legal question of whether, at prong two of Strickland, Mr. Akinsadi established prejudice that met the second prong of the Strickland standard, and whether the district court, in making that legal determination, that prejudice had not been established at prong two. And I would also say, Your Honor, in response to Ms. Sproul's argument, this court does not need to reach the retroactivity question for this case. Padilla informs this case but does not control it, because Padilla's holding was limited to the Strickland prong one question. In this case, Strickland prong one is not at issue. Pre-Padilla, Judge Williams in the district court found that counsel's affirmative misadvice was ineffective assistance and satisfied prong one. Where Padilla matters is not, and so the question of retroactivity, he had already brought this action. He's not barred from bringing this action pre-Padilla. Whether Padilla is retroactive or not doesn't matter, whether he could bring this quorum nobis action based on the ineffective assistance. Where Padilla informs the court's analysis is what Padilla said about the centrality of deportation as a concern and the vital link between criminal proceedings and deportation proceedings, and the comments of Justice Alito about how affirmative misadvice undermines the very reliability of the proceedings. So I would posit that I know the court is going to reach retroactivity. I know there's a case that's scheduled for next month on the question of Padilla retroactivity. This is really a Strickland case, and it's a Strickland prong two case. And certainly Padilla's language and the Supreme Court's discussion of ineffective assistance and the Sixth Amendment right informs the court decision. It also informs the fact that, as Judge Wynn was asking, in 2000, it's clear that the advice was absolutely wrong. And the Supreme Court said in Padilla, for at least the past 15 years, it has been a matter of law that an aggravated felony makes you automatically deportable. 15 years because it was in 1996 that Congress passed what we call IRA-IRA, Illegal Immigration Immigrant Responsibility Act. And that was a radical wholesale change of the immigration law and introduced a whole list of new aggravated felonies. The question of whether he would have renegotiated his plea if he'd had the proper information, Judge Gregory, that was your question. I would just say in this case, there were, as an immigration lawyer who works with criminal lawyers on these kinds of cases all the time, he absolutely could have renegotiated his plea. In fact, if he had actually pled to theft, what his counsel told him he was pleading to, and received a 30-day sentence, it would not be an aggravated felony. Yeah. Because under 101A43G, for theft to be an aggravated felony, there has to be a one-year sentence of imprisonment imposed. A 30-day sentence, there would be no aggravated felony. So there are a number of ways that he could have pled to different charges, and the way I work with criminal counsel today, we work together on crafting pleas, and the Supreme Court in Padilla discussed the creative way that plea bargaining can occur to avoid deportability. So that factor is also there. Your Honor, my red light is on. I could talk all day, but I know that you have other things to do. So unless there are other questions.
No, there are no more questions. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our last.